Welcome to the Campus Energy and Sustainability Podcast. In each episode, we talk with leading campus professionals, thought leaders, engineers, and innovators addressing the unique challenges and opportunities facing higher ed and corporate campuses. Our discussions will range from energy conservation and efficiency to planning and finance, from building science to social science, from energy systems to food systems. We hope you're ready to learn, share, and ultimately accelerate your institution towards solutions. I'm your host, Dave Carlscott. I'm a Director of Energy and Sustainability at Brailsford and Dunleavy.
And it's diplomacy, right? Diplomacy and then, like, I guess, passive-aggressive aggression. You're just consistently asking for the same thing year after year. So I guess that's the tool of how I communicate.
You know, if all I've been told to do is recycle when I can see that, like, the world is on fire, like, why should I try to do anything, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I try to get my students to stop crying in my class and get to work.
I think it is that very interesting balance of, like, your individual actions are making a difference because that's comfortable and it's like helps with the climate anxiety to be able to feel like you're making a difference. But at the same time, you want to feel like, well, your individual actions, like, it's not all on you.
In this episode recorded in April 2024, I hand over the role of podcast host to Lena Essack, a recent graduate from Lewis and Clark College. I have the pleasure of answering Lena's questions on the topic of climate communication, along with two other guests, high school teacher Tim Swinehart and law school professor and climate negotiator Lisa Benjamin. Lena gives us a great setup, so I'll let her take it from here.
Thank you all so much for being here. I'm really excited to talk about this really important topic of climate, energy, environmental communication. I am a senior economics student at Lewis and Clark College. I work in the sustainability office with Amy Dvorak on energy and climate initiatives, and I'm really excited to have this conversation here. Last summer, just to give some background on myself, I worked for a renewable energy company in the community relations department. And then obviously now I'm working with college students and staff at the college. And these groups require very different communication techniques and education techniques. Obviously, climate-related information can be extremely technical, really difficult to communicate. So I'm really excited to hear about all of your experience and your thoughts on this topic. So just to start, if you guys could each introduce yourself, who you are, what your job is or your role, and what climate and energy communication or education looks like in your work. I guess, Dave, do you want to get us started?
Sure. My name's Dave Carlscott. I'm the Director of Energy and Sustainability at Brailsford and Dunleavy, which is a national firm that works mostly as an owner's advisor to public institutions. So my specific role, I am leading our energy sustainability practice. So I'm helping our clients, which are largely like public universities or K-12 schools or other organizations like that, grapple with either energy questions or enacting climate change, climate action planning, all the way to climate implementation projects of that nature. I'm also building a team where I've got folks that are more broadly sustainability. So building that out as well. And then our firm also does a lot of work with public-private partnerships. So we're trying to get private capital in to do work on public entities.
Awesome. Tim, you want to tell us about yourself?
Sure. Thanks. My name's Tim Swinehart, and I am a high school social studies teacher. I taught at Lincoln High School here in Portland for almost 15 years. Yeah, so for me, and I've taught about the climate crisis in my social studies classes for at least that long. And so I think, yeah, climate communication, I guess, for me means or looks like sharing stories, I think, largely as a social studies teacher of people who both are affected by the climate crisis and, you know, making sure to sort of story the disproportionate way that that plays out in our communities and around the world. In a nutshell, that's kind of what climate communication looks like for me.
Awesome. And Lisa?
Hi, my name's Lisa Benjamin. I'm an associate professor at Lewis and Clark Law School. And I work primarily in energy, climate change, environmental justice, climate justice. I engage primarily with my students who are law students who are thinking or worrying about climate change. I work primarily in international climate change. I talk to them about the treaty structure and what countries are or are not doing around climate change. And then I also engage with other stakeholders like journalists. So I'm often giving interviews to the media. I used to be involved quite heavily in the UN negotiations, and I still Had a role up until the end of last year on the compliance committee. And so I would communicate with my fellow negotiators. And that's always really interesting. Yeah, so it's very varied. And then I also do a lot of writing and scholarship where I try to communicate areas in the law that either are working well or are not working well.
Great. Thank you. So I guess the first question is fairly broad. You can take it however you'd like. It's really thinking about tools and techniques related to climate communication. So just thinking about my experience to give you some examples. When I worked at EDP Renewables, the renewable energy company, a lot of the communication techniques that we used, they sometimes felt old-fashioned to me. Of course, I'm only 22 years old. But it was a lot of contacting local newspapers, making phone calls, a lot of, you know, face-to-face conversations. And we focused a lot on the economic development, economic incentives around climate change. And now at the college, we're printing fun stickers, we use social media, obviously very different forms of communication. And also the students just care about it for different reasons. They're a lot more value and moral focused. So I'm curious about your experience with the audiences that you all work with, what tools and techniques you use to communicate to your various audiences. I guess, Tim, if you want to start, I know you already mentioned storytelling. If you want to talk a little bit more about that or any other specific techniques that you can think of.
Yeah, I guess, again, like, you know, confronting this as a social studies teacher, I think has been a interesting, maybe a little bit unique thing, at least in the K-12 setting for me to do over the years, because it's so often that kids get climate education in their science classes. And so I think that early on, it just felt really important to kind of help kids build empathy. The way that the climate crisis was affecting people, you know, again, kind of like nearby and far away. So the storytelling can look like any number of things. It can look like the role plays, the curriculum that we've written. I've had a chance to work with a collective of educators here in Portland and across the country through Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project. And so, you know, we've developed a variety of different pieces of curriculum where kids are kind of like put into the place of sharing, you know, the stories of activists. We have one role play that we wrote recently that's about kind of imagining the future. And so it's really looking at like, how do the stories of, say, like someone who's working on houseless advocacy in St. Louis, how does that mesh with an indigenous rights activist in California and, you know, a number of other stories. And they kind of bring those to the table. And then they work from those perspectives to try to figure out what a just and fair and kind of empowered solution to the climate crisis might look like. And, you know, so I guess that gets at something else, which is just the ability that we have to trigger our imaginations when we're talking about these issues, because I think it can be, you know, it can be instantly defeating to look at this issue from any number of angles, right? Whether you're looking at the data, whether you're looking at the lack of progress over the last 30 years. And so I think it's really, just really important for kids to see those stories of people that are engaging, you know, continue to just do all the important work that's actually happening in the world that it's just kind of hard to see sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Lisa, do you feel like you use the storytelling techniques in with your law students, or is it kind of a different ball game when they're when they're older?
In a way, I guess I do. So the students that come to my international climate change class often have a lot of anxiety over climate change. And so I try to use different media because we have to start out with the science, and it's really hard to, but that's really what you need to understand where we are globally. So I try to use some of the videos that the IPCC produces, which are really helpful entryways for them. And then I have a negotiation simulation for them where they're each assigned a country, including oil and gas countries, petrostates, you know, large global north countries. And I come from a small state, and so I tell them that that's the perspective that I negotiate from, and that's the perspective that I often have. But you have to engage with all these other countries in order to make progress, whether you want to or not. And so students are randomly assigned, including countries like Saudi Arabia, and they have to negotiate on behalf of their country to get the best deal that they can for their country. And they do it with the text that is available for that particular conference of parties for that year. So whatever issue is on the table, or primarily on the table for negotiations, that's the text that they use. And so I sort of force them to really think about the limitations of international law and how you can and cannot use that including through coalitions, negotiating with your fellow students who are also similarly minded and differently minded, and how to come to consensus and how extremely difficult it is to reach that consensus. And so ultimately depends on political will of countries like the United States, where they are, and they have a lot of power in this country. And so I try to kind of let them see that the international regime works so far, and we've made a lot of progress comparatively considering, you know, the countries that are involved, but there are limitations to what the law can do. And so a lot of it does actually come down to political will within certain countries. So that it seems to help them kind of understand the realities and limitations of international law and where you can push and be more progressive as well. And they actually have to research their own country, look at their nationally determined contributions with each country to figure out what are the vulnerabilities. And a lot of them are assigned to countries in the global south, because I think it's really important that they understand how many developing countries are really struggling with the climate crisis. So I try to get more active participation from them instead of just sort of telling them what the law says. They engage with it, and they engage with the text, and they have to figure out how you can or cannot make progress in these areas. And I guess from my scholarship, it's more activism-based. I really do write a lot about small states and some of the limitations in international law and some of the real struggles and vulnerabilities that these countries are facing. And so that is where sort of much more the activism comes in terms of the scholarship that I write. And then, yeah, negotiations are, they're their own unique kettle of fish. And I have been working in the Kyoto Protocol compliance mechanism for, I think, 11 years now. So it's been a real privilege to work with fellow negotiators. But it takes a long time to make any progress in that kind of forum. So I've been plugging away at it, but it, you know, you really have to have the patience of a saint to kind of see the long-term perspective of what you're working for. So, and it's diplomacy, right? Diplomacy, and then, like, I guess passive-aggressive aggression. It just be consistently asking for the same thing year after year. So I guess that's a tool of how I communicate, but, you know, none of my colleagues are surprised that I take that perspective. So.
Well, it sounds like the simulation is a very important technique of actually having the students go through it, like not just to teach about it, but actually experience it. It seems like a very effective way of really learning through what you're doing. Dave, did you have anything else you want to add? I know obviously you're doing this podcast, and that's a form of communication. So if you want to talk a little bit about, you know, why you're doing this podcast, that would be awesome to hear.
I think there's actually a podcast about why I'm doing the podcast in an earlier episode, so I'll refer you to that one. But I thought what was really interesting is listening to both Tim and Lisa, how similar teaching social studies students and international climate negotiations are similar to trying to convince risk-averse administrators and public institutions to do something. They're scared. They are freaked out. They don't know what to do. And a lot of the work that I've been doing has been trying to figure out ways that I can communicate a path forward that they can A, understand what it is and articulate it, and B, get excited about putting their back into it. Because anything they do is very similar. It sounds like Lisa's work is hard and slow. But once things happen, like you go like nowhere, 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 and then massive transition can occur. And so I think those are the moments you're always looking for. So a couple of the things we've been doing, I mean, I started in software. So I was actually trying to like take data and make charts and do that kind of stuff. And that was cool. And I learned a bunch, but I'm not sure I necessarily communicated a lot to many other people because it just freaked them out. And then I've moved from that into more of a consulting role. And we're using really simple things like, here's a sample plan of somebody else had done. Here's the same plan with all of the things blanked out. You fill it out for yourself. Make this yours. But just, this is one page. You only get one page. You can't, like, you go down 15 rabbit holes. You know, things really, really simple like that, that have taken us a lot of time and effort to figure out what works and what doesn't. It's been about iteration and trying stuff, trying something else, trying with a different audience. Sometimes people take it a different direction you weren't expecting. Sometimes that's great. Sometimes that's not so great. So I've been trying to get my reps up and learn from each type of communication that we're using.
Yeah, interesting. The next question is about data. As an economics student, I love data, but I think sometimes it can be really useful in communicating climate-related information. Sometimes I think it can be really scary, especially when it's really technical, kind of what Lisa, you were talking about. It's really hard to communicate really technical information. Or if the data is skewed, that can be problematic. So I think you all work with data in very different ways in your work. So this question is really about how you use data. Are there times you choose not to use it? And if so, why? I guess, Dave, do you want to get us started?
Sure.
You mentioned data in your last question. So,
yeah, well, I guess one thing that we always end up doing is cleaning up data before I can even get people to do anything. A lot of times they have data, which can be anything from entire complicated, you know, software systems to a single spreadsheet that somebody did or a student project that they're proud of, but that was kind of like somebody's student project and then they left and they're not even at the school anymore. And so the first step we're always having to do is come in and say, okay, what should it look like? What data are you missing? And how do you pull all that together? And I've always been surprised at how much you can, it's not making up data because you don't want to do that, right? Like you want it to be based in fact. But a lot of times just putting a number in where there should be a number relative to the size of what it should be for decision-making at least is really the only level of data you need. A lot of times it's the incompleteness of the data that's the problem. It's not the granularity of the data. Like if they know generally how much electricity they use, that's enough to talk to an administration about getting a renewable power purchase agreement. They don't need to know the 15 increments of their last 10 years, for example. Like there's different uses. Like if you're running a power system, you need that level of detail. If you're making a business case, you really don't. I mean, it needs to be credible, but it doesn't necessarily need to be like super, super accurate. And so a lot of times I'm filling in a number and then we're trying to make it better or correct it or prove it's right, as opposed to like waiting until it's right before we put it forward. I think that's one thing I've learned about the use of data in communications, maybe if I tie all that together.
Mm-hmm. So because you're really working with a lot of raw data in your work.
We'd use like utility bills. We'll use financial models. We'll use financial budgets, the capital budgets, historical purchases, gross square feet of campus size or number of students, or, you know, there's a bunch of different things and they're all in different places. They're all in different formats. So a lot of times we're just cleaning it up, putting it in a more of a storytelling format so that you can do something useful with it. And what we're doing with it is trying to get a group of people to coalesce around ideas so ultimately they can be creative, you know, with what to do about it, as opposed to just wallow in despair that they haven't made progress, which that happens too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Tim, I think you'd mentioned kind of storytelling as being data. Will you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I was thinking about how to talk about that. And I think one of the things that comes to mind is the Marshallese poet that I've used in my classes. Her name is Kathy Gentnell Kitchener, and she's a climate poet. And she kind of like came to prominence by speaking at a UN climate conference probably a decade ago. But she has a poem that I use with students called 2 Degrees. And the whole point of the poem is to kind of look at various statistics that represent the way that the climate crisis is affecting, you know, specifically her home in the Marshall Islands. The whole time she's trying to personalize the numbers and the data, right? And so like she uses her daughter to start with, and she talks about like what a difference 2 degrees can make with a child who has the difference between a 99 degree temperature and 101 degree temperature, right? And really like making an effort to humanize them, because I think, you know, I do think it's easy at the levels of bureaucracy where negotiations and attempts to address the crisis have failed in so many ways for decades now, that it's easy to kind of lose sight of what these numbers represent, right? And so for me, I think that's something that I'm always really making an effort to do. And, you know, and something like her poetry, I feel like can do that really strongly. And then, you know, one of the ways that I have students respond to that is to then write their own climate poems, kind of trying to like connect their own stories and their own personal worries and concerns and issues into the poems that they write. And so, yeah, I think that's just, I was trying to remember the quote. I can't remember it, but it's something along the lines that the mark of a truly civilized person is someone who's brought to tears by statistics, you know, and that's, I think, in some ways what I'm trying to do in my classes. Not to make students cry all the time, but
yeah. Noam Chomsky, he gave a talk at Lewis and Clark during COVID, like an online talk, I remember. I hope it was Noam. Lisa, do you have anything you want to add about the way that you use data in your work?
Yeah, it's funny. I try to get my students to stop crying in my class and get to work. Now, Tim, you and I have to talk. So a lot of the data that I work with is climate science data, and the IPCC, I think, tries to do a good job making what they call summaries for policymakers, and I use those reports, my students read them, and I try to choose the graphics from those reports quite carefully to use graphs and maps that are actually easier for them to figure out the differences and what the overall picture really looks like. There's a lot of graphs that they use in their reports, some of them that I find challenging, and the IPCC generally uses what they call calibrated language, so you have to understand the key to what that calibration actually means before you can start figuring out what it says. So it's a process, but I think it's really important for them to engage directly with those texts. I guess similar to Tim, there's a graphic that I use quite a lot that shows the difference between 1.5 and 2, which is a huge critical negotiating point for slum states and other vulnerable countries. And that graphic looks, I point out certain parts of it, and one of it's like at 1.5, we'll lose 90% of coral reefs. At 2 degrees, we'll lose 99%. And I was like, that is all horrible, but that 10% actually is really critical for a lot of countries. And so I try to pick and choose the graphics that are digestible to them. And then I try to dig into the data a little bit more, because they will all come saying China's the largest emitter. And I'm like, yeah, they are today, but let's look at historic emissions. And so I try and choose graphs that show the historical emissions of global North countries, tie it back to wealth creation, and why developing countries are so clear about the lack of historical responsibility of global North countries, and why, you know, they really need to think about where those emissions, like who's responsible for those emissions in China. So a lot of them are manufacturing goods that are consumed in the global north. And so I'm like, let's talk about consumption, because that is a big deal, right? So I try to dig below some of the like statistics that are there, just to make it clear to them that there's a lot of inequities, even among the, you know, the data that we find. And you have to understand, and of course, from global north country perspective, you know, they're like, well, we're doing, you know, we're not responsible for the largest share anymore. So why should we be responsible for it? So they have to understand each country's perspective behind the data to understand why we are at such a, you know, difficult juncture to make progress. And then I guess the other way that I use data that I think has recently become really interesting is there have been a couple of requests for advisory opinions from international courts. And those are courts like the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea, the International Court of Justice, and a couple of others, the International Court of Human Rights. And I've been involved in two of the briefs written by NGOs to those courts. And part of my job was to actually look at the climate science and try and translate it and link it to legal obligations for judges that don't really work with climate change at all. And that's actually been a really interesting exercise. We've obviously had climate scientists review the legal brief, but it kind of illustrates to me once again why I use climate science so much in my classes, because you end up doing this kind of work and, you know, the people who are making these decisions about these advisory opinions need to understand the context within which we're working. And you only understand the context and the vulnerabilities and the harm caused to countries by understanding where we are with the science. And so it's actually been a really interesting and kind of and tough exercise to figure out what to pick and choose from the data that will, you know, give the judges the perspective of the rest of the legal arguments that you're making. So,
Lisa, do you find having law students, I mean, people must come from really different undergraduate backgrounds, that maybe some people do have more technical, scientific or mathematic, whatever it is, that they understand the data easier. I mean, do you have a broad range that makes it difficult to pick and choose data?
We do have a broad range of students that come to us, but a lot of them have actually done environmental studies or environmental science before they come to law school. I actually find that more and more of them have, because they really want to do environmental law. So that's actually really helpful. But I mean, you know, I don't have a science background. I've had to learn how to interpret IPCC reports, and you learn by doing, right? I mean, you have to really dive into the report. So I encourage them, just like, even if it's shocking at the beginning and the writing style is very different than legal writing style, and, you know, there's a lot of data and statistics, you have to work with that. And it's the same if you're going to be a commercial lawyer, you have to understand business statistics and profit and law. So, I mean, you know, you have to engage with it.
Yeah, very interdisciplinary. Well, this next question I have is, I think, a pretty important one, especially being myself part of the generation that feels like climate really affects our future. And I think we all feel, well, not all, but me and a lot of my friends really feel the responsibility to save the planet. It feels like it's placed on us. I think this is in part driven by this like doomsday approach of kind of scaring people with climate communications. And I think it can, in some ways, encourage people, but in other ways can leave them feeling really disempowered, like our individual actions don't make any difference. So I'm curious how you guys use this doomsday scenarios, maybe more negative approaches in your work, if you do at all, and how you kind of communicate this really scary stuff and then could still do that and being able to motivate or support your audience to make a difference and feel like their small actions are making a difference. So another kind of big question, but this one's really important to me. So I'll be really curious to hear. Tim, if you want to start, I'm curious how you deal with this with high school students, because I think they're the youngest generation that you work with directly, at least among the four of us.
It is. It's such an important question. I think my approach to teaching about these issues has changed over the years as a result. You know, I feel like 15 years ago when I started, it felt like I was just trying to help students see and understand that there was a problem to care about, because, you know, it wasn't showing up in the way, especially in our lives, right? Like here in Portland, for example, that it is now. So it kind of feels more like my job as, you know, as a high school social studies teacher, kind of addressing this issue now, is to help them kind of see and believe that there's a world worth saving, worth caring about in the future. Because I think what I see so often is kids that are just kind of, you know, like you said, these doomsday scenarios are kind of, they show up so easily in films and books and, you know, in real news too. You know, like if you really like dig into this and let yourself sort of immerse in what's out there, I think that's a very like reasonable place to end up. I think that what I'm trying to do, one, is to really help students see all of the various social movements that are out there that connect to the climate crisis. When I say social movement, I mean that can look like people who are in the streets with signs, they're at the IPCC meetings, they're in Washington, you know, and that's sort of our standard, I think, definition of social movements. But it can also look like so many community activists that are finding ways locally to dig into working on regenerative local farming, or just a variety of approaches to, you know, dealing with houselessness, right? These are all climate issues. You mentioned kind of taking an interdisciplinary approach. I think that's actually a really empowering thing in a lot of ways for kids, because I think if this feels too technical, if it feels like something that is just a scientific issue that, you know, for some really complicated reason that maybe at least in high school, they can't, no one really wants to engage with them about, like, there's just not a lot happening. It feels really like a doomsday scenario. But I think if it feels like something that connects to a variety of different issues that they see and they care about, from like nature protection to houseless issues to racial justice to indigenous rights, like kind of whatever it is that kids are like caring about. And if they see that those things all connect, and then they see that there are people working on all those different issues in all these really like cool ways. One thing I'll add to that too, I think that teaching as a history teacher, I think teaching the history of social movements is also really important, because there's also this way in which we've sort of lost our sense of time. Maybe it was a pandemic, maybe it was, you know, all the social media that we're in the middle of, but it feels like we're kind of living in this timeless era where no one has done anything up to this point, right? And that's why the climate crisis is so bad, because no one's acted. And in some ways, sure, you know, but there are also decades of social movements. Again, people who have just done tremendous work, you know, on environmental justice. I was just writing an article, in fact, about the 1991 First National People of Color Conference in Washington, D.C. And there are just these incredible stories of these activists that came from all over the country and came to kind of help define what environmental justice would be, specifically from the perspective of people of color. And they were doing that at a time when the mainstream white environmental organizations just dominated the narrative, right, in terms of environmental issues. And their work 30 years ago is why now you can look all over through government in like local kind of settings and see people talking about environmental justice, seeing those people, seeing those social movements, and then feeling like they can begin to connect personally to some of those issues, I feel like it's just so, it's such an important way of countering that kind of doomsday scenario.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Sorry, I get kind of fired up talking about that. So I think I went on for a long time, but...
No, I think what you said about joining organizations and joining specific movements, not just like the movement of environmentalism, but specific ones like in the Portland community is a really good point. I'm in a class now about data, data and democracy. And I remember at one point our professor asked the whole class, like, who here is part of an organization? And nobody raised their hand. And I think that's really telling of all of these college students who are, I think, care a lot about climate change and a lot of environmental and issues outside of climate change. They're like activists, and yet they're not actually a member of any organization. So yeah, I think that's a really good point and definitely made me be like, oh, I should join an organization myself. Dave or Lisa, do you have any responses to that?
I'll take one. I have the joy of working with lots and lots of universities, so I don't ever have to use doomsday scenarios to, you know, I'm not the one leading off of that because I usually have entire student organizations like storming the president's office before I even show up. I think I've learned on how do I channel that? How do I take the passion that's in that, which is really, really powerful, and turn it into something that can actually get policy or infrastructure or the things that need to come out of that from a decision maker to happen. I've joked, I think, even on this podcast about saying things like, I wish I could get the students to say things like, we demand low temperature hot water in our pipes, you know, or something like that, which obviously they're not going to do because they have to have the technical knowledge, to some of Lisa's points earlier. What I am having some success with is making sure that the student voice provides the moral clarity to the leadership at the right points when we're trying to make the big pitch. Because if you have a student present something like that, and you arm them with a compelling, coherent business case, yeah, you're no stopping. That people are, that's like the superpower of students.
Yeah. Yeah. Lisa, do you have anything to add?
A few years ago, I realized that a lot of my students were showing up with a lot of eco-anxiety. And they were coming to a climate change class, obviously having some background and information on it. And it's using this video, it's by Yale Climate Connections called The Emotions of Climate Change. And it's actually great. It's a couple of climate experts who, you know, like me, would just launch into the science and be like, this is what's happening. And like not recognizing that you're freaking out your entire class. And then I just leave, right? Okay, reading production. And so it's a great video where, you know, people who work in climate change have to recognize, particularly if you're dealing with the general public or students, that you are inspiring a lot of fear and anxiety that they probably come to the conversation with anyway. And this video is great to recognize like the shame and the emotion that you might feel with climate change, and recognize that it's normal to feel that. It's actually good to feel that. And you have to recognize and name it, because as we move through the class, you will learn more and more about the vulnerabilities of specific countries. And so I think that I play that in the very first class. I'm like, this is how you might feel throughout the semester. And I want you to recognize that that's okay. And, you know, you're going to have to manage that and not ignore it, because it's a healthy normal reaction to, you know, some of the information that you're gonna hear. And so I think that tends to help starting off a class like that. And then often students will kind of individually come to me if they're really paralyzed by it. And I remember reading a report by, I think it was the American Psychological Association, that, you know, if you go to a doomsday scenario, the reaction is often apathy, right? Like, there's nothing we can do about this, so we might as well not try. You obviously can't be overly optimistic, because that's inaccurate and unethical. And so you kind of have to try to be honest with the students that this is the reality that we're facing, and these are the potential trajectories. And some of them are absolutely horrific, but some of them we can actually still manage. And so I try to give them this information that we are at this really critical juncture. And if we don't take action now, then, you know, things could get really bad really quickly. But we are at this juncture and we have to take action. And then I try to kind of convince them to empower themselves. I mean, they are American voters. There's very few more powerful people in the climate crisis than American voters. I mean, that's the sad reality of international negotiations. And I'm like, you have all this power. Please tell me that you're using it and you're making decisions appropriately in terms of how you are voting and your consumption lifestyles. And, you know, it's not all on you. but a lot of it is on politics. And so like Tim, I started out in this work when climate denialism was absolutely socially acceptable. You know, you confront these views and it was like, I don't know how to deal with that. And sort of now, although I am very, you know, saddened by the lack of progress that we've made, at least the sort of outrage and the anger, and yes, there's despair, but I try to get my students to focus on the energy of the outrage to take action. Like use that emotion to actually make things better, as opposed to falling into doomsday and despair, because who did that help, right? It's not, you know, it's not going to do anything positive in the world. And so that's how I try to craft the obvious emotions that we all feel mm-hmm. about it.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about how this has changed over time. Do you really feel like the way that you've taught your classes has, in terms of this like doomsday scenario, was that really different 10 years ago than how you're doing it now? Or is that just from what you've learned? Or is it really because like the social, the way we talk about it has really changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's been about 15 years now that I've been working in this field. And even the IPCC reports, their language has escalated in terms of, you know, certainty to inevitability. And so as the science evolves behind the science, sadly a bit too behind the science, the sort of language and social discourse has evolved as well. And, you know, we are seeing more and more extreme events, which, you know, people are sometimes are connecting to the climate crisis as well. So I think in the past 15 years, I have definitely seen a shift in attitudes by students around climate change and a lot more anxiety around it, which I think is natural, given the information that, you know, we're all digesting and the events that we're all living with. So I have certainly seen a shift. It's not like all of a sudden we've overcome opposition. That's not what I'm saying. But, you know, it's just the way that the conversation works now is different.
Mm-hmm. David.
Yeah, I double down on that because I think in the lot of the work we're doing, I mean, people hire us often for a climate action plan. So at that point, if you get hired for a climate action plan, they've recognized that there's a thing that they want to do. But in some cases, I'm hired for other reasons that have to do with energy and aren't really to do with climate change at all. People don't deny, they just don't want to talk about it, or they just want to imagine that the thing they're doing is good and it's great, you know, better than it used to be, or, you know, they'll kind of give you language like that. And I think what I've come to realize is adults are just as freaked out as 22-year-olds or 15-year-olds, like in my house. They just have developed more different ways of toxically behaving when they get freaked out. I think maybe it's a good way to put it. And so, you know, the nice thing about youth is you're still like open to like trying to figure it out. You're not imagining that you have it all figured out. But I think once adults get to that stage, they act in really sort of almost predictable, but fairly toxic ways, reacting to that fear. And so I think in my work, I don't have to play that card ever. In fact, I usually am probably a little overly optimistic in the business case type language that I'm using, because they're already freaked out. I'm trying to pull them out of that. My personal view is like, you know, I think, or if I'm talking to a person one-to-one, you have to like come to grips with it at some level. Like, yeah, it's terrible. And I'm choosing to get out of bed in the morning still, you know, what choice do I have? And I've heard people in, you know, some other social justice movements kind of say that, like, you know, if you were Black in 1950 in the South, you didn't have a choice. It just was, you know? And so, you know, just because we're used to being able to have a choice, we don't, and even in this country. So I think it's more just focusing on, I have limited time. I don't have time to like give another one-on-one on how terrible things are. Let's just go and figure stuff out is kind of the attitude that I take in my work. But, you know, that's not to say that everybody should do it that way. That just fits for the place where I'm at and the work that I'm doing.
Right. Because everyone kind of comes at it like they've already established that they care about it.
Yeah. Or that them caring about it is irrelevant to whether we're going to do anything about it. Maybe is a different way to say it. Like for those that are denying or delaying, it's like, I just have to find a different way to get them interested in doing the thing that I need them to do for the thing to move forward. And usually that thing is in its own right. It's like, wow, don't you want reliable, clean energy that you don't have to have the prices spiking all the time and that doesn't break down all the time? And, you know, I mean, there's other ways that you can make the same case without ever talking about climate change. And they should be, you know, inherently compelling on their own right.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Can I?
Please, please follow up.
That question about how things have changed, I think that as somebody who's been very consciously teaching about this for 15 years, I think I've tried to make changes, I think, that are in line with kind of what other folks have said here and what I've talked about a little bit. One thing that I wonder sometimes, because I still hear from students that they're kind of receiving a lot of the same environmental education, kind of the bits and pieces that they get that when they come to me as juniors and seniors in high school. I don't know how much our approach to teaching about the environmental crisis, the climate crisis, has changed in K-12 in one way that I think is really important. And I was thinking about kind of the shame that Lisa talked about. And even climate anxiety in general, I think, you know, has obviously a lot of roots, and it's complex and it's important, you know, to understand a variety of ways. But I think one of the pieces of that, especially for Americans, that is really important to recognize is that we have a very hard time conceiving of ourselves working collectively with other people. And, you know, take the way that environmentalism is taught to kids. And if you go to an elementary school, I think, and you look at elementary school curriculum, and even some of the high school textbooks that I've analyzed, I think they do this very distinctly American thing where we focus on individual action. And all of us growing up, like, we, you know, that's what we were taught, right? I mean, my climate awakening moment was super cliche. I was at a local theater here in Portland, and I was watching Al Gore, right, in An Inconvenient Truth. And he, you know, everybody in the theater kind of had this epiphany, perhaps, you know, I certainly did. But what does the film finish with? It finishes with a list of 10 things that you can go do afterwards, like recycling and riding your bike and buying an electric car. And so I think that there's a way that we've failed one another. We've certainly failed kids as they grow up by not really offering solutions and approaches to this issue that are really sort of that match the scale of the crisis. I think part of the anxiety or the kind of dystopian outlook that some of my kids will be like, well, if all I've been told to do is recycle when I can see that like the world is on fire, like why should I try to do anything, right? But if instead, you know, like Dave was saying, if we can look at like the civil rights movement, if we can look at a variety of other social movements where people have acted collectively and overcome like really massive social problems, I think that can help. It's not the only, right? I mean, there has to be a lot of approaches, but for me, that's something that I really want to help kids to see. And I think we need to think hard as K-12 educators about, you know, what are we at the end of the climate change unit? What do we offer as a solution? And are we actually helping anybody if we're continuing to tell kids to, you know, to recycle, right? Which, I mean, that hasn't worked anyway, right? Like not even 10% of the plastic ever produced has ever actually gone through like a full recycling process, right? Like that's intentional. Like oil companies and beverage manufacturers have wanted us to believe in this for decades, right? And so I also try to teach kids that history as well and to see where that comes from. And so why do you feel that shame when you think that this is all on your shoulders, right? And so just all of those pieces, I think, matter.
Yeah. I think it is that very interesting balance of like your individual actions are making a difference because that's comfortable. And it's like helps with the climate anxiety to be able to feel like you're making a difference. But at the same time, you want to feel like, well, your individual actions, like it's not all on you. So it is that like interesting balance of, I feel like I want to be able to experience both of those for my own sanity.
You can't do your individual actions. People ask me that all the time at the end of talks. I'm like, recycle, like bike, buy an electric car. But ultimately, it's the global politics of it, which are domestic politics that matter. So vote. Like that is the single most important thing you can ever do for climate change.
Yeah.
Yeah, I double down on that.
Yeah.
Right now on the work that I'm doing, I'm going from trying to convince people to save a few pennies on their electric bill to like multi-billion dollar capital plans. You know, I mean, it's just not even the same world. So things, talking about how things have changed. And that was, a lot of that was the IRA. And a lot of that comes down to voting. And literally one vote in the Senate would have changed it the other direction. So, I mean, that matters massively. Hmm. I think the way I think about it too, I grew up and had parents that recycled and, you know, did all that. I grew up in Montana and I still do. You know, I'm glad to live in a city like Seattle where we have a lot of those things are just normal. Like I don't, you know, think about, and not all of it's perfect, but I've actually visited the place where my compost goes and I've seen them process it, you know, and
and to have a sense of what that's like. And it's not perfect, but it's way better than seeing all that stuff in a landfill, which I've also visited, you know. So I think it matters. It's a yes and problem. But, you know, kind of doubling down on what Tim said, and there are a lot of really great people that talk about things like Leah Stokes, I think, does a really good job. She's a professor at UC Santa Barbara, but she's done a really good job of changing the language to, you know, vote and, you know, do the individual actions, but do them in the order that they matter and do them for reasons that are driving you forward and your life forward. I think Amy Westervelt's done a lot of really good work on the history of climate denialism and like things like cooking with gas and some of those phrases that you hear that were literally just, you know, things that the gas company was trying to sell more product. I mean, it's like not different than a Coke ad or whatever. Once you understand it, you can't unsee it. It's sort of like being in the Matrix and all of a sudden you can see where you are. It's frustrating for a little while because nobody else is seeing it and you're kind of surrounded. But once you get a bunch of other people around you that also see that, that stuff doesn't affect you in the same way. And you're not ridden with guilt because you can see through it.
Yeah, I think that point about like the history of climate denialism is really important because similar, I work in climate litigation as well, particularly litigation against states and companies, non-state actors. And it's the same tactic with tobacco, right? It was personal responsibility. It's not us. Like, you have to take responsibility for this crisis. It's your own health. And they're doing the same thing with climate change, right? Like, it's not us. People demand the products. And so, you know, the fact that, like, an electric vehicle is not easily affordable until the IRA, for example, that's not part of their narrative. And so it is a purposeful and pernicious argument that it's your fault, right? You have to fix it and take that on. It's just A, not realistic, and it's not going to actually change anything. And then it'll change something, but not everything. And so I think understanding that the sort of perniciousness of that message is really helpful for you to figure out, like, what are the big things that I can do through politics, basically, to actually hold companies and countries accountable. And, you know, it really just comes down to the governments you vote for in these countries.
Well, I just wanted to add one last thing, too, to the voting conversation, because I think as important as it is to vote someone, say, like Joe Biden into office, right, so that other Democrats that were able to work together to pass the IRA, I think that the Sunrise Movement, which has been a really important outlet for young people all across the country, would also claim that the IRA may not have happened, or at least wouldn't have had some of the provisions that it does, if it weren't for social movements pushing politicians to do the right thing, right? Which has always been the case. Lyndon B. Johnson didn't want actually to sign the Civil Rights Acts, you know, all on his own. He had to be pushed to do the right thing. And that has always been the case for any politicians, I would say, that have helped to make history, is that they have had people in the streets, in the halls, in their offices, you know, wherever it is, reminding them, hey, this is why we voted for you. This is why you're here. And we expect you to do the right thing.
Amen.
Yeah. Amen to that. Well, I don't want to take up too much of all your time. I guess I'll just finish with kind of a lightning round question to kind of sum everything up. We've kind of looked at the past, the present. I kind of want to look forward to the future. If you guys could just say in a few words what you think climate communication in the future looks like in your work, whether that's personally or more broadly in your industry.
I would talk about, just from my student perspective, I really hope for passion from them around the climate crisis and action. And again, not the personal action, but like passion that translates into positive actions that actually fulfill change, which is what we need in the next 10 years, 8 years.
Yeah. And I guess I would second what Lisa just said. And I think the last few years have really been focused on is imagination and really trying to help students to try to help them imagine the world that they do want to live in and that they're willing to fight for. Because I really believe that we have to be able to see that to sort of have the hope and the desire to work for it.
I would talk about, just from my student perspective, I really hope for passion from them around the climate crisis and action. And again, not the personal action, but like passion that translates into positive actions that actually fulfill change, which is what we need in the next 10 years, 8 years. Yeah.
Thank you. Those are good answers. I guess I will give one more kind of wrap-up question because I'm also really curious what you guys all have to say. I'm curious, what are some things that you point people to in your work with the audiences that you all work with when people want to learn more, when they want to do more? Like, what's the first thing that you point them to?
For teachers, that I always point them to the Zen Education Project. It's kind of like a hub for created social studies, kind of social justice related curricular materials. And there's a teach climate justice component of the Zen Education Project. And I would be happy to share the link.
Yeah, that'd be great. We'll definitely link that. I think when this gets posted, that would be awesome.
I'll name two. One just that got me into this world at all was like reading the World Resources Institute annual report documents, which is kind of like probably some of what Lisa gives to her law students. I found it to be fascinating reading, but it was more accessible and a little less dense than some of like the IPCC stuff. The one that I absolutely must call out would be the Energy Transition Show by Chris Nelder. He does insanely researched episodes of like whatever topic that you'd ever thought of, like, you know, the history of coal in India to like esoteric rate design and utilities to thermodynamics to like climate science to methane cycles or whatever you can think of. And he's done like 200 of them and they're all like an hour long and they all have like 75 footnotes. So, I mean, if you really want to get into the topic, work your way through that catalog and you'll know a lot about a lot of things.
Very cool. I'll check it out.
I think that the Yale Climate Connection, the Emotions of Climate Change video is really helpful for people who are struggling with how to deal with the climate crisis. I always find it every year. I watch it every year and I find it really helpful. IPCC videos, they're on the website. So instead of the report, like watch the videos, they have like these little snappy, like the music is very inspiring and they have these sort of snappy statistics that you can have a look at just to give you an overview of where the science is very obviously briefly. Climate Action Tracker is a great website if you're interested in what countries are or are not doing. They're outside of the UN system and they rate countries. And so for my students who are assigned countries, I tell them, go look at what this NGO is saying about your country and what you are or are not doing. So that's often a really useful snapshot. And then for more specific information, if people are really interested, every country has their nationally determined contribution online at the UNFCCC.org website. And they're actually often quite short and accessible. The countries write them and say what they're doing. And I have my students read them, obviously, for the countries that they are in. So if you actually want to see what a country is saying about what they're doing, and then look at the Climate Action Tracker website to see what they're actually doing, it can sometimes be a nice contrast between the two. So the reason they're public is because we pushed as negotiators to have this information in the public so people can read it and, you know, find out what countries are saying and then have a look at what they're doing. So please read them.
Well done. Thank you.
Thank you all again for your time. This was really interesting and I hope to continue working with you guys at some point in the future. I hope this isn't our last conversation.
Thanks, Lena.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Thanks, guys.
That's it for this episode. A special thanks to Lena Essack for her great job hosting and planning this episode. Thanks to Amy Dvorak at Lewis and Clark College, who introduced us to Tim and Lisa, and Trevor Jolly for his editing and production assistance. Our music is Under the Radar, courtesy of Dallas-based musician Gio Washington Wright and his studio big band. You can find us on LinkedIn or the web by searching for Campus Energy Podcast. If you have a topic you'd like us to dig into, please reach out. We'd love to hear from you. As always, thanks for listening.